Chapter 2.
This is your captain speaking,
the voice announced on the public address system within the Pan American jet.
We will be landing in Binh Hoa, South Vietnam, in about 40 minutes. They are reporting sunny skies, temperature of 97 degrees, and 100% humidity.
Whoops and cheers erupted from the military passengers.
Welcome to hell!
Someone called out. The captain continued.
As you know, we passed through several time zones since leaving California. So let me take this opportunity to get you all up to date. First, there is a time difference of 31 hours between Vietnam and the west coast of the United States. For example, in Oakland, where many of you started your journey, it is 8:30 on Friday morning. And right now in Vietnam, it's Saturday, August 7th at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Again, some comments referring to a time machine and blasting into the future echoed from the rear seats.
After we touch down, we're asking everyone to remain in their seats until the plane comes to a complete stop. There will be no need to panic and rush for the doors, as this airport is one of the more secure areas of South Vietnam. It is very safe where we are landing, and nobody is in danger. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the scenery. On behalf of the crew, we hope you have enjoyed your flight. We do wish you the best of luck while you are here in Vietnam, and Godspeed for a safe return home. Thank you for flying Pan American Airlines.
Yeah, right, like we had a choice,
one of the soldiers uttered loudly to his companion across the aisle. John was looking at his watch and trying to do the math in his head. Bill, do you know it took us almost 26 hours to get here? Hard to believe, isn't it? You may also want to think about us being on the other side of the world from Tennessee. It just blows my mind. I thought China was on the other side. Didn't you ever hear people say that if you dug straight down in your backyard, you'd end up in China? Who's going to do a damn fool thing like that? Nobody is. I'm just saying that I grew up with it. You city folks have some strange notions about things.
Bill returned to watch the scenery passing below the cabin window, hoping to see something more than just clouds and ocean. Prior to leaving Oakland, an army doctor had given Bill some tranquilizers to take prior to departure. On the first leg to Hawaii, he sat in a half-comatose state in the window seat next to John. The effects had worn off an hour before landing in Hawaii, and after fully regaining his senses, Bill found flying to be rather enjoyable. He would tell everyone that his favorite part of flying was the takeoff, and how he enjoyed the same sensation as the astronauts must have felt when they left for the moon. During this long flight, he had spent most of the time looking out the window, enchanted by the view from that height. It was a new world to him, and he savored every minute. Bill grabbed John by the arm and pulled him toward the window.
Look, Pollock, you can see land, he said excitedly.
John leaned over Bill's legs to see for himself. The word spread quickly, and everyone started crowding the windows for their first look at their destination. After flying over water most of the time, it was a pleasure to see land below. From 15,000 feet, Vietnam appeared as a vat of shimmering colors. Bright blue threads snaked through shades of green, brown, and yellow-colored earth. A large mountain chain was visible in the distant northwest and seemed to cut the country in half. It became quiet throughout the cabin as the laughter, talking, and singing suddenly ended. The steady roar of four jet engines continued, but was unnoticed as every passenger fixated on the scenery unfolding below. As the altitude of the plane gradually dropped, the vistas below changed in shape, color, and became more recognizable. Soon the sprawling city of Saigon and its neighboring villages took shape and grew in size as the jet approached and flew overhead. Cars and trucks appeared as they inched along the roads. On the final approach for landing, the tiny, ant-like moving dots took the shape of thousands of people moving about. The plane landed smoothly and taxied toward the terminal. A few moments later, it stopped abruptly, and the engines began their dying throes. There was an absolute hush on the plane, and the rapid heartbeats of 200 new arrivals hammered in unison. Suddenly, a loud noise erupted in the front of the plane when the cabin doors slid open. Everyone on board was fidgeting about, trying to get a better look at the doorway. An Air Force major walked through the opening. He was dressed in his best Class A uniform, with several rows of battle ribbons proudly displayed over his left breast. Following him inside were two Army captains, dressed in green jungle fatigues and baseball caps. The trio walked up the aisle, stopping at the forward flight attendant station. They stood for a moment, surveying the new arrivals. The major stepped to the side, lifting the microphone from the mounting plate on the wall.
My name is Major Brown, and joining me are Captains Willis and Sharkey. We welcome you to Bien Hoa Air Force Base in the Republic of South Vietnam.
All eyes fixed upon the major as they listened intently.
Our job today is to get you men off this plane, through customs, and finally loaded onto buses that will transport you to the reception center. We want to complete this portion of your in-country training safely and in an orderly manner. After disembarking this aircraft, I expect to see everyone joined up and standing in four perfect ranks out on the tarmac. When we are certain that everyone is present, we will then proceed to the baggage area inside the civilian terminal. There, you will secure your duffel bags and proceed directly to the area marked customs. The officials will have you empty the contents of your bags onto counters and perform a search of your body. The MPs will be looking for drugs and any other illegal contraband that you may be trying to smuggle into the country.
At that moment, many soldiers exhibited some nervousness. Some frowned and rolled their eyes. Others stirred anxiously in their seats with a panicked look upon their faces. The major continued.
If anyone is concealing contraband, then I strongly suggest you drop it in your seats as you leave this aircraft. There will be no questions, and nobody will come looking for you afterwards. This is also your only warning. Once outside, there are no second chances. If arrested, you will be taken to LBJ, which is Long Bend Jail for you, Cherries. There, I guarantee you will serve some hard time for your foolishness. When you clear through customs, you will then exit the terminal and board the awaiting buses. They will transport you to the 90th Replacement Center in Long Bend, which is about a 3-mile drive. There, you will begin final in-processing and assign to your new in-country unit. At this time, I would ask that all officers aboard please stand up and begin to disembark at the front door.
As they moved up the aisleway, John and Bill noticed a few items left behind on the seats. Bags of weed, pills, and other unidentifiable items lay openly or tucked between cushions. Bill and John shuffled down the aisle toward the front of the plane.
Look at this stuff. Do you think these people carried it with them all the way from Oakland? I seem to recall that some of us were searched before getting on the plane.
No, I don't think so, Bill. It would have been too risky in Oakland. The guys must have bought this stuff during our three stops along the way. There were a lot of shady characters in those terminals, and I remember seeing a lot of money flashed around.
Yeah, you're right now that you mentioned it. I can remember overhearing some people talking on our stop over in Guam. They were talking about having a big party once they settled into their new digs, but I didn't think it'd be with grass and drugs.
Shit, Bill, dope users are on the rise. This stuff's getting really popular back home, and more people than we know are turning to it. Just give me a beer, or a mixed drink and my cigarettes, and I'll be happy.
I'm with you there, partner. I wonder if anybody's going to try and smuggle some dope into the country.
Your guess is as good as mine. Each person walked out of the air-conditioned plane, hesitating briefly on the top step of the boarding ramp as the full impact of hot and humid air engulfed him. For a moment, it was difficult to breathe. Some made a feeble attempt to re-enter the plane, but the rush of exiting personnel pushed them back out. There was a green hue outside, as rays of silvery sunlight reflected from everything colored olive drab green. Helicopters, planes, gun emplacements, and buildings with sandbagged walls surrounded them. Dozens of helicopters were lifting off and landing in areas next to the runway. Small green single-seat Piper Cub airplanes and larger Phantom fighter jets were also moving about and taxiing toward different areas of the airport to wait in lines for their takeoff. Bill and John cleared customs easily and walked out to the waiting buses. The vehicles were identical to those used during training on the American bases and were painted olive green, like everything else around, with one distinct difference. There were no glass windows. Instead, bars and chicken wire covered each framed opening. The two close friends took a seat in the first row behind the driver.
Why is all this shit covering the windows instead of having glass?
John asked the driver.
It's there to protect the passengers from grenades or any other foreign objects that might be thrown in from the side of the road, he answered.
Protect the occupants? It gives me the feeling of being a criminal on the way to prison.
We are in prison, my man, the person behind John said with a smile. Think about it. We're all locked up in this country for the next year, and there's nothing we can do about it but serve our time.
Yeah, you're right,
some of the other passengers agreed. Once the buses loaded, the drivers closed the door and started the engine. Two MP Jeeps pulled alongside, stopping next to the lead bus. Each had long 15-foot whip antennas swinging from the two rear corners and dual M60 machine guns mounted to the crossbar behind the front seats. The soldier standing behind the guns was busy loading them and ensuring they were in proper working order while the other guy talked casually into the handset of the radio.
Look at the Rat Patrol Jeeps, John exclaimed.
What's a Rat Patrol Jeep? Bill asked.
Don't you remember seeing them on TV when we were young? They were always kicking the shit out of the Germans in Africa during the Second World War.
Well, you know, I never had a TV, Bill said quietly.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Just take my word for it, Bill. They were a badass outfit.
The procession of five buses began to move, and both gun jeeps raced to the head of the line and fell in. As the convoy picked up speed, red dust from the road swirled through the air, making it difficult to breathe, the horrible residue immediately coating everything. As if on cue, the new arrivals began choking and gasping for clean air. The passengers quickly pulled out handkerchiefs or used shirts to cover noses and mouths in an attempt to filter some breathable air from the thick red fog. The convoy appeared to be traveling through a corridor. Both sides of the road had a 10-foot-high barbed wire fence running alongside. Hundreds of small, straw-roofed huts, about the size of a single-room lakeside cabin in the States, stood as far back as they could see. The barbed wire fences made it appear as if the area was either a prison or a refugee center. Every person they passed appeared to be very old. Some were in front of their huts, sitting on the ground or cooking over open fires. Others simply stood near the fence and watched the parade of buses pass. Every one of them was chewing something and spitting a brown liquid onto the ground.
"Those people are chewing tobacco," Bill exclaimed. "That's not tobacco," the driver volunteered. "It's the juice from betel and nuts."
"What the hell are betel and nuts?" John asked.
"The areca nut grows wild in the husk of some trees around the country. These people cure the nut and slice it into sections. For chewing, they wrap a few slices of betel leaf and add a lime, clove, or anything else to improve the bitter taste. When taken like that, the stimulant causes a hot sensation in the body and heightened alertness, although the effects vary from person to person. However, most of them mix other shit with it to get high, too."
"You mean like dope?"
Bill asked the driver.
"Yeah, exactly like dope. Most of these people are high all the time. They wouldn't be able to stand it otherwise."
"Just look at all those folks by the wire. They remind me of the cows back home. All them standing along the fence and chewing their cud. Their heads turn as you pass, and they keep watching you until you're long gone."
The driver laughed.
"That's original."
The convoy approached a tight right turn, and each bus slowed to complete the maneuver. Several groups of villagers were standing at the corner, waiting for the traffic to clear. Just then, John grabbed Bill by the arm and pointed out the window.
"Bill, take a look at that!"
Speechless, they continued to stare at the sight greeting them. A group of seven women, each appearing to be close to 100 years old, was standing on a corner, waving to the buses as they passed. Their wrinkles were deep and wide, their skin dark and shriveled like prunes. It appeared that most were heading home after working in the fields, since they were carrying rakes, hoes, and shovels. Two of them balanced long poles on their shoulders with large bamboo baskets attached to each end. They wore black nylon pants and oversized shirts, covered with dried mud and stains. All of them wore straw conical hats that helped to shield their faces from the strong rays of the sun, and they were smiling broadly. Many were toothless or had only a few teeth left in their mouths. All looked as if they had mouths filled with black licorice. Their lips, gums, teeth, and insides of their mouth looked like posters from the Cancer Foundation, warning against the dangers of smoking.
"That's what happens when you chew those betel nuts all your life," the driver explained.
Bill and John could only look at each other and shake their heads in disbelief.
"Damn,"
John finally said, in one long, drawn-out breath. Further up the road, Young children were everywhere. Most were small boys of preschool age.
Hey, G.I., you souvenir me cigarette. Candy, you number one,
they called, running along the side of the road to keep up with the buses. Some of the people on the bus felt sorry for them and began flicking cigarettes through the chicken wire windows. This resulted in several scuffles as each group began to zero in on the tossed tobacco sticks, fighting each other to claim the prizes. In the background, behind the packs of fighting boys, stood the little girls, not any older than 8 years or so. Some held half-naked babies in their arms, and others shouted at the fighting youths. A few of them even entered the fracas and began to pull the boys apart, appearing to scold them.
"Why are those little girls holding babies?" John asked the driver. "Those little girls help raise the family, cook and clean around the hut while their parents work in the fields."
"Oh, that's so sad," both responded together. Every human being passed so far on the convoy was either old or very young. There were no teenage boys hanging around on the corners, no young or middle-aged men walking around in the villages. At another turn, the buses slowed down again. One corner had a small outpost shaped like a triangle. Large bunkers were at each corner of the complex. Machine gun barrels poked through several of the gun slits. A 20-foot-high tower and spotlight stood guard in the center of the compound. Loops of barbed wire and walls of sandbags encircled the small base. Overall, about 20 Vietnamese soldiers moved about the compound. It was unlikely that any of them weighed more than 100 pounds.
"Look at those guys.
They're only kids."
"Shit, Bill, we're not much older ourselves."
"Yeah, but we can put in our year and go home. These poor guys probably live up the road a piece, and they're going to have to continue fighting this war long after we're gone."
"I guess you're right, Bill. I just can't imagine having to fight a war in my own neighborhood back home. It's got to be hard keeping focused on a day-to-day basis when you don't know if your property will still be there or if your family's okay after a firefight. What a life of hell."
5 minutes later, the bus made a left turn and slowed to a crawl as it approached a gate straddling the road. It reminded the young soldiers of Fort Apache, as portrayed in old Western movies. A sign over the gate read, "Welcome to the 90th Replacement Battalion, Long Bend."